Morning special. Sometimes I wonder if that's too much for an early morning.
Good morning. Hope everybody's dancing their way into this Wednesday. If it's the start of your Wednesday, if it's the end of your Wednesday, maybe we're giving you a little dance lift into the to the close of your day.
Because how many Europeans do we have with us hanging out today? Come on, everybody, give us a big shout out in the chat.
Oh, there's a hope.
Good to see you. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, we got a fantastic guest here today, Chris.
We certainly do.
Mr.
Oh, am I supposed to say who?
Learning Ninja himself.
Moan Blackard.
Very cool. Yep. Brian Duzablon's with us here today. When we got a really crucial topic to cover off a bunch of thoughts on today, Brian, we'll get you to introduce yourself to the folks who have not heard of or met you before. We'll start there.
All right. Thank you. So I'm Brian Duzablon, founder and chief technology, philosophy, philanthropy officer for Learning Ninjas. Been doing e-learning and that whole thing for 20-something years now. Feel really old. been focused on accessibility and kind of this universal design and inclusion for last 5 to 10 years, a little more heavily. So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. And in my own history with 508, we've certainly, you know, on our side had lots of times over the years where 508, for instance, has come up for a long time, going back to my own earliest days, probably not quite the 20-year mark. But what's really been cool for me in the last few years is to see how many non-governmental organizations and et cetera that are actually taking on accessibility. They're bringing it up early on in a project or in a vendor process and saying, tell us about the accessibility. And for a long time, it was just strictly those who were, you know, legally bound by the, by the regulations, being a government or that kind of an agency. So it's really been really quite, I would say, exciting and really awesome to see that more and more of the world is actually getting on board finally.
Yeah, it's nice to see, I think, it switching from compliance and avoiding lawsuits to doing the right thing.
And doing a better thing too. Yeah.
Better, yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, like what you were saying earlier about universal design is something that has just recently come up that I had forgotten about actually. And that is just sort of that idea of inclusive design. We often just default to 508 or the WCAG. The new, like you were saying, the new compliance, you know, requirements, and we kind of feel forced into it as opposed to thinking of it as just good all around design and it being just part of our natural design process. Where did, can you tell us just a little bit more about the universal design and what that is and if people can find out more about that?
Sure. So there's a couple of different terms that are being used. So there's the universal design, there's inclusive design, which in some cases mean the same thing. In some articles, maybe it's a little different. The universal design comes from architecture and physical building design. And so there are universal design principles for buildings and such. And there's some adaptations of that for learning. Jean Maripodi has a really good article and presentation on it. And there's a universal design for learning website. There's a resource link that y'all will share that I have later. Mm-hmm. But it's really just going back to the original design process at the beginning, thinking about all of the different people that are going to encounter your product, your course, whatever the thing is that you're creating, putting into the world, that everybody that's a human that's on the planet can use it or can interact with it or whatever that thing is. So the inclusion side of it for me takes to a next level around how we write, how we the audiences that we write to and that we think about who we're including in our imagery, and that we're including all different types of humans and different people to make sure that they are represented in our content, not just able to learn from it or view the content or hear the content or whatever that level is, but actually represented in the content as well.
Yeah, so it goes beyond just simply the technical aspects of being able to check the box that says, yes, there's a transcript or what have you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from a planning process, because, you know, there are, despite, you know, the good natured sense that most of us in this, we all are people, but at the same time, there are also, you know, cultural structures that I think maybe, you know, the traditions that we've been handed, the things that we've been given in our own organization. What are some of the ways then that we can help our clients or our own, you know, internal org start to move in this direction?
The best thing that I recommend is starting the conversation early and having it often. You're not going to get 100% there. We don't even know what 100% is yet, as designers and owners. But having that conversation in early project conversations rather than putting it at the end. A lot of times what we all do or have done is, you know, we have this great idea to teach somebody something. We're going to design this awesome interaction. We have a great, even if it's a great scenario, build all this cool stuff, and that works for 60% of people or something, and then you patch the rest of it, or we go in and make a transcript and say, here's a PDF or here's a text version that the screen reader might read or might not. It's an afterthought, and that's what I want to change. So it has to be a design consideration at the beginning. Otherwise, you're not a good designer.
Yeah, it's it was really cool to see in the Apple WWDC keynote some accessibility, cool accessibility stuff that they're working on in each of their products and putting such a strong focus on it with the voice, first of all, which I thought was really cool. They had a super cool video. If anybody wants to go to their website and just Google the accessibility video from the keynote, I'm sure they've got that video up there, but it's really, really well done as far as a demo and as far as, you know, what I think good accessibility is going to look like, and that voice control seems perfect for it. But you know, I wonder if the one thing I didn't see was sort of the advanced interactivity. Like, we have a tendency to enjoy things like drag and drop and things like that, and that's the one technology that I thought, ooh, that might be a tough one to make accessible, to control with the voice. I mean, I'm sure somebody will figure it out somewhere along the line, but it's really cool to see it built in or starting to get built into our systems as a default, you know?
It is, and specifically on the drag and drop, I think one of the things that happened to all of us as instructional developers is we were given a very small set of tools, and we tried to do as much as we could with those, and being creative with how we used stuff like drag and drop. But there are alternatives to drag and drop that in a lot of cases work better for everybody. So you don't have to worry about drag and drop. I tell our clients, don't ask me to do a drag and drop. We're not going to do one because there's no way to make it accessible right now for everybody, or it's too much of a level of effort. So we'll just come up with an alternative. And there are ways to use tab and selection and things like that. They kind of get to the same process or the same outcome. And
yeah,
I to touch on the Apple and kind of where we are as an industry, I think it's really great to see technology companies putting focus on it. It's long overdue, and I want to make sure that's another layer that our industry can follow, right? Another path that is, hey, let's pay attention to this and create tools that make it easier for everybody to learn and develop learning.
The drag and drops, just to circle back, because it's actually one of my bugbears. But we often just use them, you know, from a learning perspective to do something that's not particularly significantly really needing a drag and drop anyway. Like, oh, matching definitions, you know. From a design perspective, I've always felt that if there's a spatial quality to it, like putting parts in the right place or something like that, then that spatial quality of drag and drop has a value. But if we're just using it to categorize things, which again, why are we even asking people necessarily to, you know, match definitions and such? Is that even aligned to the real needed learning in a particular thing that we're creating, et cetera? But then, you know, even without, you know, folks who might have disabilities or challenges in that regard, putting a drag and drop onto a smartphone becomes a real frustrating experience because things are off the screen, you know, et cetera. So it's not even a great experience to think about designing for a multi-device world, as well as in a world that we want to make as accessible and open as possible.
Well, and even desktop, I broke my hand playing rugby in college and I couldn't use a mouse with my right hand, and I'm not terribly ambidextrous or I'm not good at my, so it was really hard for me to interact with my computer. And this is back in the Gateway days. With my left hand on the mouse. And so I was fortunate, I was doing work with a database that I could tab through, and I used keyboard navigation and doing searching and things like that. But if I had to require on clicking accurately and dragging anything that I was trying to do research on, it would have taken me double or triple the time, and it would have been very frustrating. So that was a really obvious kind of experience that I had, and it was not out of any, you know, natural, you know, what we would consider a traditional disability, like vision or it was just temporary. And we're all going to be temporarily disabled at some point, or we're getting older, so we're going to be able to see less, we're going to be able to interact less, we're going to be less mobile. All of those things contribute to potentially limited interactions with our devices, right? So the, you know, we can tap twice or use the keyboard to move an object to a spot, and that's actually better for everybody. So that kind of gets back to universal design principles. It's like the Jane Bozarth uses the ramp for crosswalks, right? Those were designed specifically for one audience, if you would say, but it helps everybody, right? And so that's what we want to do with our interactions, and that's why it has to start in design.
Mm-hmm. You were talking before we went on too about, you know, the vocabulary then, and I think you've started us down that path of, you know, switching it from accessibility to universal design and inclusive design. Are there other strategies that you use to try to help shift the mindset?
I use conversation and stories, which we should be using in our content and stuff anyway. So it actually helps the overall design process. I think there's some use in providing data. So there's statistics, there's stuff that reinforces those stories and those kind of calls to change design practice. But it really comes back to the story. Like I just said, like I had a broken hand, I couldn't interact with this thing. What would that be like if I was trying to learn something that was critical to my job or to life in any way? So talking through who are our potential audiences, we should be doing this with user experience design principles also, right? So it's like, what does an empathy map look like? What are we, who are we designing for? Are we giving them a voice in our design process? Are they included in early stages of review rather than putting all of the review and quick edits and accessibility stuff in stage 7 development, right? That's the wrong place for it to be.
Yeah, it's if anybody out there is looking, because I would like to switch the conversation a little bit over to the inclusiveness. But before we completely jump off the tech side of accessibility, are there just a couple tips we could just drop for people that are simple, easy ways, things that they can be doing right now that maybe they haven't thought of, or you know, something they can do to make their multimedia a little bit richer, as Jennifer has elegantly put in the chat.
Yes, I think there's shameless plug. There is a little primer on the Ninjas website that you can find on learningninjas.com/accessibility.
Oh, cool.
That kind of has 10 easy things you can do right now. There's you know, there's obviously the basic web accessibility guidelines, like alt text and keyboard navigation and testing that. From a technical perspective, there is a great article that's also listed on that website from Smashing Mac that has, I think it's 12 lenses of accessibility and inclusive design. And just sharing that throughout your organization, especially within your design teams, is a really good way for people to frame the conversation. Because it kind of puts you into different lenses of looking at content, motion, keyboard navigation, you know, obviously audio and visual impairment. Excuse me. But that's a really good place to start because there's some really easy tips, color blindness, grayscale. The first story that I have for why I paid attention to this stuff in early on before I knew anything is we built a security course, like a information security at a company that I was working at. And we did all this cool design for like a, it was a safe, it was in the gray, it was, we had blacked out like investigative reporting style interfaces and backgrounds. We did this whole thing and it was a theme deal. We had people test it, we had alt text, we had you know, everything we needed to do, navigation work, but then we published it out. And we had somebody with low vision take it and couldn't, there wasn't enough contrast in the gray on gray or light gray on black. And we hadn't tested for that. And I didn't even know there was a test for that. But there is, there's great tools out there. You can upload a screenshot of your course and see what it looks like for different people with different ranges of color blindness, grayscale, low vision. If they're zooming into a certain percentage on their device, you can see what gets cut off. So those are really easy things to do early on, even in a storyboard phase, yes, to do a quick check.
Yeah. We had a similar experience. We were asked by a client team to provide a sample of accessible content. And we feel pretty strongly, you know, from the technical perspective. So we sent them one of our samples, and one of the first things they came back said was, yeah, about that color scheme, there's a lot of gray on gray and such, and the contrast. And we went, oh, okay, right. It's not just about the technical details of the tool. It was the design. We went, oh, right, okay. Note to selves, we'll fix that up. And and make sense of that. So here we were thinking, because of what we've done, you know, in our tool, being, you know, feeling progressive about the technical specs, but then, yeah, you know, the visual choices that went into the color scheme.
And as we get global and different things, depending on who your audience is, and it is important to know not only your current audience or who you're designing for, but also who might take this next week, next year. If you want a long shelf life for your content, you need to design for a much larger, larger audience than you think. So icon choices, gesture choices, colors, you know, even if you are trying to introduce color, and text or whatever, to, in case somebody is colorblind, but even in different countries, reds and blues mean completely different things, So being aware of that is, you know, it's kind of knowing is half the battle, right? It's like, that's part of it.
Yeah, Chris and I were just in a training session with one of our clients, and she was saying the same thing. She was like, is there any way we could change the color on that? Because our customers see red as, you know, not just making it stand out, but it's not a good thing. Maybe we could change it to green. And it was like, oh, I hadn't really thought of that. Normally, like, you want it to stand out, and red is a great standout color, and you know, you just, and you know, you don't really think about that kind of stuff too much. It's those subtle little things, I think, that we do need to stop and think about. And you mentioned something too, that the hand gesture thing. I heard at one point, like, we like, I forget which one is it thumbs up? We like thumbs up, but in some countries, thumbs up is not such a good thing. It's like flipping somebody the bird. Crazy stuff like that. So, there's a lot to think about, but if we, in kind of shifting over into the inclusive part, that's a big part of that. But I think a lot of times when we think about that inclusiveness, some people just think, oh, okay, so I just need to grab some clip art of people of color, different origins, different races, different from different areas. There's got to be more to it than just that, right?
There is, I think. It's how you write, it's the words you use, it's the pronouns you use, it's across the board, checking in with your content, both visuals and text and the stories, because it's, you know, a lot of the stories that might be, you know, white collar America, like, specific or something like that, does not relate, you know, people can't relate to other people. And we're not doing a great job of that universal kind of everybody focus when we're designing. And we're definitely not doing a good job of asking people and giving people enough of a voice. And so it's really an effort that you have to do within your organization or with clients to drive that conversation, give them resources to reach out. We encourage on the any systems that your learners are accessing or whatever, give them a way to contact you anonymously and talk about content and accessibility issues, because a lot of times they don't want to call out anything specific or self-identify, but they need to be able to tell you when something isn't working or is misrepresenting or not representative enough. So giving them a voice, a way to contact you, a way to tell you, and then taking action on that and showing that you're listening. And that's a organizational change. It's also if you haven't worked that way with clients, if you're an independent or a, you know, small team, it's a change in your process, and you have to educate them.
Is there a particular way that you help clients understand the value. I'm trying to think of a way to put this, but I've heard this from other consultants in our industry say, well, if we do it the way you're asking me to do it, it's only going to cost this much. But I really recommend that you know, there's going to be some extra production work on our end, so it's going to be a little bit more expensive to make it accessible, you know, and then the customer ends up saying, well, okay, yeah, forget about that. Let's just go with the cheap version or whatever. Are we ever going to get to the point where it's just the version we create is just accessible, period, and there's one price attached to it? Or if you have to have that conversation with somebody, do you have any tips for how to make that go smoothly?
I think the best answer is that we don't design anything that's not accessible or inclusive or universally designed, right? Like, that's the message you want to put out there. So giving them options is the first mistake. And we don't do that. This is how we're going to do it. This is how much it costs. This is the design process. And that's where it comes back to changing your design practice overall, is those conversations and working with a client to map out storyboards and personas. That's where you do that work, and it does make it design heavy, but that's how we should be anyways. So I don't think there is a option. Now, in the real world, obviously there are limitations to that, and there's timelines and different things, but the trade-offs are not cost necessarily, because you can create an amazing learning experience that's just a text scenario. Mm-hmm. So there's no excuse to, you know, say we don't have enough time or money. Sometimes you come into a project that's already, that you have to work in a certain authoring tool, and you have to work with a specific LMS that's maybe also not accessible. There are a few of those. And you just do the best you can, and you educate along the way, and you kind of keep injecting conversation and stories into your engagements with the clients and also the audience. And any little bit we can do is obviously better than what we've been doing. And then I have one really good story about the challenge of like old content and changing how you're designing. And that's Target, the big Target box store. They got sued, but they, whatever the reason was for them making the change, they still made the change, and it was a good thing. But they created a really awesome training for their employees. But they had not gone back and like made all of their old content accessible. They didn't turn it all off because it wasn't accessible. They just made a decision and said, okay, from this day forward, everything we create is going to be using these new principles, these new guidelines, and we're going to design for this moving forward. Periodically, we'll go back and make an effort to review the old content, clean it up, make it as accessible as possible, or make it more inclusive, or whatever the changes that really need to be made, or archive and recreate them, you know, put them on a new creation timeline. So it, you know, you can do it realistically within the resources that you have, but make a decision on how you want to be, what kind of designer do you want to be moving forward. Mm-hmm.
And that answers the question right off the bat in the chat. I think one of the very first questions was, how do you address going back to old content and changing it? And I think we have to do a lot of folks have to do that anyways. We had a great guest on a couple months ago talking about doing an audit, auditing and how you need to go back through your stuff anyway. One, because of Flash going away and all these companies that have hundreds and hundreds of courses all built on Flash that they need to start figuring out how they're going to convert. But if you're going to be going through that process, now would be a great time to also be auditing for accessibility and inclusiveness, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer is joining us from England was noting as part of the chat too that I mean she's facing a regulation deadline of you know this fall of taking content and moving it forward. So doesn't sound like she really has the luxury of that kind of when we can do an audit we'll circle back on the older content. And she's noted in a couple of spots that you know a lot of their content is flash based, etc. But wanting to speed up the process, you know, how do we take all those existing things? And I mean, there's no magic wand to wave over a flash-based piece of content to do these things. Plus, even just that technical change, you know, isn't going to account for everything. Regrettably, it's a frustrating thing that so much of the world did go down the path of flash content and is now. You know, staring at it because it's a walled box that doesn't make it easy to move on to something else.
Yeah, we're even stuff that's not Flash that is. I mean, I've designed websites. I've done a lot of other content that lives in it's out in the universe that I'd love to be able to take back and audit and fix. And sometimes I won't be able to because I don't own it anymore. Or I'm not working in that company, or, you know, whatever. So it would be lovely if we could do some time warping and go back and fix some things. But that's where that kind of start now and do the best we can with the auditing and the old stuff that we have to convert. As far as speeding up, you know, we overcomplicate our design for content in a lot of ways. You know, Cami Bean has the clicky, bling, bling stuff. It's almost like we started to default to some of that stuff instead of being very intentional. So as you're auditing and if you're under a short timeline, simplify, you know, cut the interactions, create a very simple story if you can. Make it text-based. You know, there's a lot of things you can do with the content that in a lot of ways we just have to copy out of Flash because the storyboards are non-existent or old. And, you know, just be creative in a very simple way for how do you create content for people to consume and learn from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a question that's also been put into the official questions panel there is where can we find resources for culturally inclusive design? Do you have any particular places, Brian, that you go to sort of keep in touch with that aspect of things, the broader inclusivity?
I work the Smashing Magazine and some of the website and marketing focused sites. Have some resources and links specific for that. The 12 Lenses touches on it a little bit. There are some Daniel Nah, a couple of other key folks that are doing really good design. The Universal Design Principles website, there's one, I think it's Universal Design for Education. So there's like a series of those or a grouping of those sites that you can start with. The best thing I think you can do, especially if you're in an organization or working with kind of a regular client, is talk to the people that are in the organization, the people that are actually consuming the content you're putting in the world, and try to get as much of a representative group to work with you during design and content reviews before you start developing. Not a pilot. That's important at the final stage, but early on when you're designing.
Yeah, getting to the pilot, you've already made something. You've committed budget. You've committed time and energy, and you're probably approaching deadline. Right. That's the time for maybe. Well, also, I guess maybe it brings in the idea of iterative design as opposed to a waterfall with a singular perspective or a place where the pilot takes place, but smaller pieces, getting feedback quicker and sooner, and being able to incorporate that feedback then in next iterations quickly too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I saw also in the your question about dyslexia and some other learning disabilities, one thing we didn't really touch on is that, but also readability and reading levels. That's a huge issue, but it's an easy one to solve. On the readability side of things, what grade level are you writing to? What are your expectations and assumptions? And it's kind of clearing out all of your assumptions. That's the most important thing. There are a couple of fonts, typefaces that are specific, designed to help dyslexia. But there's not a very thorough study of the results of those yet, as far as I know. There are some really great companies that focus on accessibility and product design and web design. They're all linked on that same page, but it's Level Access, Nobility, K-N-O-W, which you guys will like. So Nobility and Level Access are two. Derek Featherstone on Twitter, he's at Feather, is a really great resource to follow. So there's a few of those folks that you can, if you get a links from them and get connected to their networks, that's a really great way. That's what I've done, is just kind of dig through it that way and kind of pay attention.
Yeah, when you start down this pathway, you're going to find it very quickly that you're going to branch off all kinds of directions, because someone will reference something and that will take you down that direction for a while and connect you to other thoughts and ideas too. Yeah, the readability, I threw the Gunning-Fogg index in there. I was presented with that way back in I think it was like a copywriting course I was taking or something, or copy editing course. And they did this, they brought this up, et cetera. And I actually, I went to one of my favorite authors and took a chunk of text and put it in. And the readability index was, let's say, I don't know, grade 7 or 8 or something, which I thought was, okay, that's, you know, a very important and literary, you know, author, and yet incredibly accessible. And that's part of the, you know, the secret to success is not to, well, let's face it, how often don't we get copy back from the review committee and things have been turned into multisyllable words because they sound more important and stuff like that. So clarity and confusion, we don't want them. We want the one, but not the other, for sure, no matter what it is. So, yeah. Yeah. And Jennifer says she's madly taking notes and copying all these links into a Word doc. Jennifer, the good news is, the recording actually keeps in Crowdcast actually keeps all the chat there, so you don't have to rush. You can come back and scroll through the chat and find all of those all of these the links and stuff too. Yeah. So
I wanted to touch on Donna's comment about many types of dyslexia and one size doesn't fit all. That applies to all of these accessibility topics and inclusion topics, right? So that's a really good place to start early on. Is, hey, who are we designing for? Well, we're designing for everybody. So, you know, get rid of assumptions, get rid of whatever you've been doing before, and then layer in resources and techniques and things, and give control to the user. That's one of the biggest design things that we can also do now, very, very easily in everything that we're producing, is let them turn on or off audio, text, closed captions, whatever things you're giving them, give them options, put the user in control, and don't assume anything.
For sure. Lots of great stuff here today. I have to call out Eric, or I have to point out Eric's comment, utilize less verbosity and eschew obfuscation, which is, yeah, I like that. That's, let's
put that on a t-shirt.
Might not fit. It might have to be both sides.
I think eschew obfuscation should be the name of a band. I mean, it really could, make a band t-shirt out of it or something.
There we go. Perfect band.
Brian,
name.
This has been an awesome conversation, man. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invite. It's been great. Happy to,
yeah, sorry to make you get up so early. I'm glad you're not in San Diego, but so you got an hour extra, I think, or did you get 2 hours extra being in Texas?
It was a couple hours, not too bad, but if I was in San Diego, I'd be on a beach and I'd be up anyways, so you know, I'd be all right.
Worse lighting conditions.
You have to face into the sunrise.
Oh, darn.
Yeah. Hey, so Brian, can we've dropped in a ton of links in there, but is there any other places where people can go to find you besides Learning Ninja's website and to follow you or to hear more about the work that you're doing?
The Ninja site is a good one. Twitter at Brian Dusablon. I'm getting back into posting a little more regularly there. Some learn chats and different kinds of things there. There was an accessibility chat a couple weeks ago, so there's some archival stuff there. And then LinkedIn, if I'm writing any articles or anything, I'll be sharing them there as well.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Brian. This has been an absolutely a great conversation, and it's such a critical one for us to keep returning to help people move in this much better direction. Brent, do I hear the music starting up?
Yeah, I think all right. Started it.
Oh, it's the ghost in the machine. Oh, gang, thanks for joining us this week. We'll talk with you guys next week. And in the meantime, have a great, awesome time. And hope the weather's great wherever you guys are. And enjoy the coffee.
And Brian, if you haven't gotten your mug yet, I'm sure it's on its way. Or if not, Sierra will get your address and you'll have a special mug too.
That sounds excellent. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers, everyone. Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Brian.